This plenary came out of a number of discussions among the program committee about why we wanted to do PSI here. We really wanted to reflect the particular context that we're in and to think about what's going on in the region. And it also relates to a project that I'm working on that has been funded by the Social, by SHRC, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council, which is looking at the particular ways in which performance studies is emerging in Canada. Now, obviously, performance studies has been very influential in Canada in recent years. We've seen the increase of papers at national and local contexts that seem to use the term performance studies. And graduate programs are increasingly using performance studies models within their core curricula. At present, however, there are no grad programs that are actually offering performance studies specific degrees. And there have been no systematic attempts to consider how this methodology has been taught, applied, and rethought in Canadian contexts. There have been virtually no publications explicitly identifying the work of key Canadian performance studies scholars, and Canadian researchers, maybe even more importantly, Canadian topics are rarely acknowledged in mappings of the field found in international performance studies anthologies. And we have sort of a joke up here that the most famous performance studies scholar is actually Tracy Davis. But of course, Tracy Davis teaches at Northwestern. So this has had a significant effect on those of us who want to align ourselves with performance studies and to try to get jobs both in and outside of Canada. For those of us who hope to, for example, place our books on Canadian performance with major publishers in the field, very often we're told that if our books are really going to focus on Canadian performance issues, unfortunately they won't go with them because Canadian performance just doesn't sell. And we shouldn't really bother pitching it unless we make sure to include a number of American artists within the book. This also affects our ability to articulate what we do to our colleagues and to our administrators, and also our ability, frankly, to identify ourselves to each other and form groups of scholars that have sort of mutual research interests. So one of our goals in hosting PSI and hosting this particular panel is to help generate a shared critical discourse about the work that's currently being done in performance studies in Canada. Even if it hasn't, this work hasn't specifically adopted what someone on the PSI board this week called the PSI brand. And I think actually the term the PSI brand is a really important one because one could make an argument, and perhaps we can discuss this afterwards, that PSI in Canada currently is more of a brand than a discipline because it's a way that people, when people think about how they're going to sell their program, they think, oh, well, perhaps the PSI brand might do it. But the curriculum doesn't always sort of measure up to the brand. Discuss. This panel does not claim to be broadly representative of all strands of Canadian performance studies. I think this is important to say at the outset. But our hope is that it can be, at the very least, a starting point for asking how institutional and cultural conditions have produced particular articulations of performance in a number of Canadian contexts. And finally, and quite importantly, it's our hope that we can connect these contributions to the international field of performance studies research. We don't want to simply come here and have an in-house discussion with other Canadian scholars about performance studies, but rather have a dialogue with international performance studies scholars about how the Canadian context both overlaps with and differs from other contexts, at what it might teach and learn from other contexts, how interdisciplinary scholars and artists working in the area of performance might strategically situate themselves with the PSI brand in years to come. And I should also note that one thing that's actually been really, on this topic of Canadian in relationship to international performance studies, it's been really interesting talking to a number of the graduate students from Queen Mary, for example. Are there any graduate students from Queen Mary here right now? So Megan, for example, a couple up there. Because as we've been talking to them, we've been really realizing that some Canadian performance studies models actually are being professed in the UK, and perhaps sometimes professed more in the UK than they are here. And that's because of Jen Harvey and Michael McKinney, who were trained with a number of Canadian scholars in this context. So, and they have brought... Hi, Michael. Thank you, Michael. Michael, the Canadian missionary. And Jen's here, too. Hi, Jen. So those kinds of connections, Canadian performance studies abroad, is also really of interest to us. So we welcome everyone to be part of this conversation. So I think we're going to go alphabetically. We're all going to give, not me, but everyone on the panel is going to give a short position paper throwing out some thoughts about articulations of performance studies in Canada. As Rick said to me a couple weeks ago when we were talking about this paper, everyone is making this up for the first time because there has been no discourse in this area, so please bear with us as we try to think through these things for the first time. And I will just introduce each of you before you speak. Okay, so Susan Bennett is first, B. Susan Bennett is university professor and professor of English at the University of Calgary. She is widely published in theater and performance studies across a variety of topics and time periods. Her most recent publication is an essay concerned with Shakespeare and the formation of identity in 19th century Montana, while ongoing projects include work on theater and tourism, site specificity in early modern performance, and cultural topographies of the city.
Thanks, Laura, and thank you for the invitation to be part of this panel. I think this is a very important moment, and I'm really glad to be part of it. And thanks to the program committee for giving plenary space for this topic. I do think, as Laura said in her opening remarks, this is both a very complicated terrain and really rather a fraught terrain. And in thinking about what I might say today, I realize I can quite cheerfully talk for the full 90 minutes, but I'm going to get a two-minute warning much before that, I understand. So I really, at this moment, still don't actually know what I want to say. So I have the thing I wrote beforehand, and I have the hotel notepaper one, too. So I'm going to try and put these two together in a rather flawed way, I suspect, so bear with me. I have three things I want to say, and I'm going to try and work through those. The first of those things is very much in concert with the opening remarks that Laura's made. And I think it's clear from looking at the PSI program that there really is a very strong presence of scholars in Canada across a variety of disciplinary locations who are producing top-tier performance studies scholarship. And that, I suppose, in and of itself is a good thing and a healthy thing. And thinking about the field in Canada, it seems to me, and Rick might have a slightly different take on it, but I think it probably emerged in about the mid-1990s that there would be performance studies scholarship being written in Canada. Yet it seems to me it hasn't really established itself as either a teaching or a research field. And what I want to start with here is, I think, the knotty problem of institutional context, because I think that's at the heart of this issue of its viability in this country. And because it's about institutional context, it's rather boring, I think. But I need to draw on the fact that I've spent a great deal of my time, alas, in university administration and scholarly service, out of which this comes. So I want to talk about that a bit, and this is from the written paper, and then I have a couple of other things that I'm beginning to think are perhaps more important than what I wrote in the first place. So what I want to do is to unravel some of the ties that bind through our post-secondary institutions, government agencies, and scholarly associations to suggest some of the challenges if performance studies is to gain traction as a collective national project. And I can say, as someone who's now lived half their life in England and half their life in Canada, one of the things I've learned living in Canada is national projects are really important, that national identity is still something that matters within this particular country. So The history of performance studies in Canada, as Laura pointed out, in the post-secondary domain, insofar as it exists at all, has been a history of its function as an add-on to existing departmentalized disciplinary fields, most typically as theater and performance studies. Or it has existed as a non-departmentalized collaborative program. And I want to suggest that these fragile arrangements have not really effectively served the development of the field in this country, and to identify a set of integrated problems that performance studies scholars in Canada will have to address if the field is to prosper. And central to what I mean in this citation of prosperity is the education of undergraduate and especially graduate students in the full range of performance studies methodologies and subjects. It is also, of course, about support for research, about the appointment, tenuring, and promotion of professors in the subject area, and about the kinds of knowledge mobilization networks envisaged by our national funding agency that Laura's already referenced, the Social Sciences and Humanities Research Council of Canada, which we refer to as SHRC. So let me start with research funding at SHRC, because I think that this illustrates very well the linkages between various institutional sites and the precarious position of performance studies in this context. And certainly there's no inhibition to performance studies scholarship being supported in the current funding structure, so long as the applicant can pass muster under another cognate category, since there's no adjudication committee within the existing SHRC arrangements that includes the words performance studies. And it's important, I think, in this context to note that the word studies is not per se an anathema to SHRC-based definitions, since cultural studies, women's studies, environmental studies, interdisciplinary studies, quite a few others, all appear under the committee rubric. So Laura, who currently holds a standard research grant, which is the sort of meat and potatoes of research support in Canada, for studying performance studies in Canada, tells me that she was successful by applying to Committee 3 in SHRC, which is the Fine Arts Committee. The Fine Arts Committee is defined on the SHRC website as the history and philosophy of art, architecture, theater, music, film, dance. So these fine arts, it seems to me, don't really encompass performance studies as most of us practice it. And it's a reality that with increasing numbers of applications and more or less stagnant budgets at SHRC, the percentage success rate for the standard research grant applications is in a state of slipping quite exponentially. Last year there was a 34% success rate, this year there's a 25% success rate. And in that kind of crunch economy, it tends to produce committees that are going to be more conservative in passing the relevant disciplinary practices for their committees' range of responsibilities. It's also worth noting, I think, at this moment, that SHRC is doing what they call a program architecture renewal. And under this, and they're actively promoting it for introduction next year, and under this description, the number and definitions of committees is not being expanded. In fact, it's being radically contracted. And so it's very unlikely that we would see performance studies added into their scope in any time soon. So we might consider then, how has SHRC devised their existing disciplinary definitions and clusters that then go on to produce these particular adjudication committees? And the most likely answer, it seems to me, is by way of scans of departments and programs at post-secondary institutions in Canada and elsewhere, but mostly in Canada, and importantly through the presence of national scholarly associations, which SHRC also fund in particular ways. So this leads me to say something about national scholarly associations, which I think have also contributed to where we are or aren't with performance studies in Canada. I want to recognize, first of all, what Laura's called the PSI brand, and to understand that as deliberately international, that it's responding to a world that is at least in some ways post-national, and insisting on good intellectual grounds that those of us who are doing performance studies work should meet on those terms. But as I've suggested in terms of SHRC, and I want to go on to suggest is equally important in terms of universities and colleges in Canada, a national scholarly association plays a definitive role. And at present, there are a handful of associations where I think there's a regular appearance of performance studies work: the Canadian Communications Association, Association for Canadian Studies, the Association for Cultural Studies, and the Canadian Association for Theatre Research. And the last of these associations, the Canadian Association for Theatre Research, CATR, has been my sometime intellectual home and the home of several of us, most of us, I think, on this panel here today. And based on the conference program from that association's meeting, which almost all of us were at last week, it's very welcoming of performance studies scholarship, and there's lots of performance studies work on their program. But at the same time, I recognize there are structural difficulty that all the accommodation in the world isn't going to address. The CATR has its own complex and fraught history, which I won't get into here, I think, but it is certainly, its mandate is to represent Canadian theatre history, and I certainly recognized when I arrived in Canada in the 1980s how marginal the study of Canadian theatre was in the overall sort of vista for Canadian studies in Canada. And I can remember going to somebody in my department and saying, you know, what Canadian plays should I read, and being told there weren't any, you know. So CATR has had that particular cross to bear, it seems to me, and it has, as its mandate, an aim to, and this is taken from the website, to shape Canada's theatrical present and future by preserving and interpreting our theatrical past and investigating areas of contemporary theatre and performance. It goes on to say, one of the most immediate of the arts, theatre is inseparable from the historic fabric of the nation. The association seeks to promote public awareness of the tangible significance of theatre and drama to our cultural heritage and makes representations to various funding bodies to support research in this field. In other words, its primary commitments, as they should be, are to theatre and to Canada, to theatre in Canada, sites that still need scholarly attention, obviously, and advocacy, but which don't in any meaningful way allow for performance studies as we practice the field, or as this organisation, PSI, would imagine the field. And so it seems to me we cannot or should not imagine that these sympathetically minded scholarly associations are going to lobby with SHRC and with post-secondary institutions on behalf of the presence of performance studies in Canada. Rather, these associations have their own other and frankly competitive reasons to do otherwise. So I think that the absence of a national presence in that way continues to inhibit the growth. Trickier yet is the appearance or non-appearance of performance studies programs at college and university levels. As I've said already, insofar as performance studies has emerged in this country, it's been as an add-on to already existing departments or as a coalition of existing faculty appointments as a non-departmentalized program. Obviously, where performance studies is added to a department's mandate, it's precisely that and only that, an add-on to existing curriculum, existing objectives, to traditions, and to assumptions. Where it's a coalition among faculty from many different departments, there is, I think, a much more compelling, perhaps, an interdisciplinary depth to the intellectual range of that grouping. But as the short-lived graduate program at Calgary pointedly demonstrated, much more vulnerability. Without core faculty directly appointed to a unit, availability of staff to teach core courses, to supervise, is always sort of dependent, at best on goodwill from other departments, but much more realistically on budget availability, some sort of latitude in university budgets, which has all but disappeared in the last couple of years. Moreover, the emergence of degree-granting programs is, at least in the two provinces I know firsthand, which is this province of Ontario and my home province now of Alberta, you're liable to approval from provincial governments or provincial government-mandated agencies for the existence of a program. And, of course, the measures for approval, for the approval cycle, go around market and hireability. So a market that you've got to prove that there are students wanting to do this, and you've got to prove that there are going to be places for students to go with that accreditation at the end of your program. Obviously, they also require evidence of scholarly presence. A national association would be handy then. And success with external funding. 2 minutes, okay. I have things that are more important than that. Okay, I was going to talk about the complexities between provincial and national funding. It is important, I think, in Canada to sort that out. In brief, provinces support the training of students and the federal government supports research, and I think there's not a synchronicity there that works against the emergence of new disciplines. Okay, the two other things I really want to say. One is very brief, which is I think if there were to be a going forward initiative out of this conference, and I hope there will be, I think it's enormously important to understand that as a coalition, not just of those of us who work in post-secondary institutions, but of what I would call broadly cultural workers. And I think there's a substantial production of performance studies scholarship within other sectors, artists, of course, but I think in working with agencies in cities and health regions and so on that we should be engaged with. The final point, and I really try and keep this to 2 minutes, which I think is crucial to make here, more complicated, more urgent, more deserving of attention than we can give it. But performance studies, if it is to establish itself in Canada, cannot reproduce the blind spots and omissions of other disciplinary practices in this country, which is, and I also want to say to Laura here, this is not to be construed as a criticism of this conference, but rather a criticism of all of us who imagine that we produce performance studies work in Canada. We live in a country whose indigenous culture is performance-based. And native ways of knowing depend on and believe in performance to understand, to live in, to take responsibility for our world. We are settlers here on someone else's land. 100 kilometers east of Calgary is Blackfoot Crossing, which is a site on the lands of the Siksika Nation, what we would call in English the Blackfoot people. It's a site where Indigenous Canadian identity is performed as a resistant and counter-public. Next weekend, June 19th and 20th, Blackfoot Crossing will be the site for the World Chicken Dance Championship, which is a competition that refuses the national borders that have divided this continent and which celebrates Native identity as performance. It celebrates performance at every age of life. There are competitions from the youngest people to the oldest. And it celebrates performance as intrinsic to the habitation of this land. I will go there next weekend, and I will go there humbled, as I always am when I visit there, by how little I know about this land that's been appropriated in the production of Canadian identity, the identity of the passport that I now hold. If we are to have performance studies in Canada, we really need to acknowledge that we have a great deal to learn about how it's been practiced here for a very long time. So thank you.
Our next speaker is Aaron Hurley, who is an associate professor of drama and theater at McGill University. She is the author of Theater and Feeling and the forthcoming national performance representing Quebec from Expo 67 to Céline Dion. Her research to date has focused largely on contemporary Quebecois performance and national performatives in Canada. Aaron.
Good morning, and thanks again to Laura and the programming committee for allowing me to participate in this conversation as well, which, as we've all now said, is not one that we've had extensively or in any sort of sustained fashion. As a result, what I feel like I can offer this morning are a couple of impressions based on my experience and observations of scholarly practices, in particular in my primary field of research and my emplacement in Quebecois theatrical performance. That this roundtable amounts to an initial and preliminary conversation about PS in Canada may be a sign of performance studies' somewhat shallow roots in these quelques arpents de neige, or few acres of snow, as Voltaire so memorably, if dismissibly, called this country when it was still a French colony. And possibly the roots are shallow because of the snow. But I think with Susan, other scenarios are probably more likely. Among them are the facts that PS scholars are spread out across Canada's regions, as we've just heard, and that the vast majority of us do not work in PS departments. I realize that this state of affairs is not unique to Canada. But there's also something quite Canadian about it that I want to draw out. In as much as it's Canadian, in as much as it manifests the federalist politics of regionalism that structures our educational and performing arts institutions. regionalism, which is a kind of wonderful fantasy of commensurate public spheres and equitable access to public services across a vast and varied landmass, is also supported by federal financial mechanisms like, just to take one example, the Equalization Payments Program, whereby those provinces with inferior fiscal capacity are given transfer payments based on the revenues from provinces with superior fiscal capacity in order to ensure, and here I'm quoting the government, which is why all these things, reasonably comparable public services across the country. This also means, regionalism also means that in the public university system, which means virtually all Canadian universities, professional and graduate programs are distributed across regions to ensure uniformity and equity of educational opportunities, and then distributed within regions to reduce redundancy so that you don't have two medical schools, for example, next door to each other. What I propose to explore in somewhat more depth, however, in the next couple of minutes is the impact of national narratives, and here's where my remarks chime, I think, most closely with what Susan's just said, with these national narratives, imaginaries, and histories on the development or lack thereof of performance studies in Canada. I've alluded already to a very powerful national narrative, that of regions united under a federal system that apportions finances and legislative responsibilities across different areas for the common good. This story, which is also in its bureaucratic structures a condition of possibility, has deeply marked the story of the genesis of a truly Canadian, decolonized performing arts culture, especially in English Canada. And by truly Canadian, I mean not English or French in its high culture models, nor American in its popular culture domain. In short, it has been argued, the regional theater system, for example, allowed for the efflorescence of Canadian drama and theater, and that drama and theater is often linked then mimetically to the experiential realities of that region. In Quebec, the narrative and imperative of identifying, recognizing, distinguishing, and building the nation has, I think, both opened and closed doors for performance studies. In Quebec, as in much of Canada and indeed other settler nations, the performing arts have often been called upon to render national service by representing le pays, or the country. One of the effects of this effort at proving the nation's existence via cultural production, and again, briefly, the nation needs to be proved because there's no state apparatus to secure it, right? And Quebec is independent. So one of the effects of this effort to prove the nation's existence has been an embrace of a rather expansive range of expressive behaviors as national or Quebecois performances. These include, but are not limited to, humor, stand-up comedy, and monologues, vaudeville, improvisation, clowning, drama of all genres, image theater, folk dance exhibitions, folk rock and independent music, film, crafts fairs, television, and acts of speech in public itself. So in the context of a minority culture within Canada's federal system, that equalizing model, these forms were valued and are valued for their French language expression, for their ties to oral tradition and rural cultural practices developed in New France. Thus, for example, the contemporary stand-up comic is an inheritor of the conteur or storyteller tradition. And they are valued as evidence of Quebecness, Quebec experience, or values. This formal eclecticism in terms of objects, combined with the analytical penchant for theorizing the social political effects and stakes of representational practices, set the terms for discussion for a growing professional class of university scholars and of university or cégep or college-trained performance workers beginning in the 1960s and 70s. These were the formative years of the arts professionalization, francisation or Frenchification, and Quebecicization. There's a similar narrative, of course, in English Canada as well in this period. This foundational eclecticism and sociocritique finds echoes then in contemporary training programs at, for instance, the preeminent training institute, theater training institution in French North America, the Université de Québec à Montréal's École supérieure de théâtre, which favors multidisciplinary training and reflexive research creation processes. So in their PhD program in Études et Pratiques des Arts, or Arts Studies and Practices, The program is offered through the schools of theater, visual and media arts, and of design, as well as the departments of dance, art history, and music. So we have this kind of coalitional model. So on the one hand, I guess the point of this section is that the national project opens up the door to PS-type objects and methods of analysis in Quebec, even if they are not named as such. Even as this national imperative has waned, and indeed I should stress that the national question is, as such, is no longer particularly active and certainly not dominant in current French language scholarship on the performing arts in Quebec. So even as this national imperative has waned, some of the more exclusionary lines it drew around qualifying performance within that narrative remain in force. And by exclusionary lines, I mean exclusionary to the sort of complete efflorescence of performance studies in Quebec. I'd say that those lines are drawn in two places. One, around commercial middle-brow performance, like the mega musical and broad theatrical comedy of the summer theater variety, both of which are hugely popular in Quebec and major employment forces. And second, the line is drawn around cultural performances like, for example, literary legitimation crises or trade union demonstrations or the canceled reenactment last summer of the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, which was the decisive battle in the French and Indian War that won for the British Lower or French Canada. Take briefly, for example, Brou, or Brew, which is a play about three guys in a tavern, which is why it's named after beer, right? The comedy is not only the most popular one in Quebec ever in terms of tickets, it's also, as of 2008, the longest-running play with the single cast in the world. It's run since 1979 to almost always full houses. Okay, so it travels around Quebec. Quebec also loves its mega musicals, which pleases me, and its musical reviews, including things like Notre-Dame de Paris, Starmania, Elvis Story, which happens in English and in French, depending on the night, Dalida, Une Vie. So, but negligible academic interests, right? Except me. In sum, the boundaries seem to me to be drawn around expressly artistic forms, right, of expressive behavior that mark themselves as performance, that are either highbrow avant-garde or popular folk. So very briefly, why? And this is, as we just said, we're making this up, so I'm speculating. First, they fall into neither folky nor avant-garde categories. These are privileged categories of nationness, or certainly have been. In Quebec, where the former, that is the folky, is a sign of tradition, and the latter a sign of that tradition's renovation and responsiveness to the new material conditions of nationality, which include urbanity and a global perspective. Second, these forms are often imported or traced on foreign models, hence Elvis Story or the musical. They remind of a not-so-distant past and of a continued not-so-benign threat of cultural imperialism and linguistic extinction. The stakes for French language expression in public and in the performing arts remain high, and this is, of course, one of the very good reasons why the question of the national narrative retains its importance, even if it's not at the forefront of current research. So I'll stop there, but I hope that these comments might contribute to our discussion about the values and the stakes of thinking PS and Canada together. Yes.
Thank you, Erin. Our next speaker is Naila Kaletamay, who is a faculty member in the MFA in Interdisciplinary Arts at Goddard College, a PhD candidate in the Theatre Studies program at York University, and a recipient of the Joseph Armand Bombardier Canada Graduate Scholarship for her doctoral research on Black performance in Canada. Naila is an interdisciplinary artist, educator, and scholar who has worked in Canada, France, Portugal, South Africa, and the USA with a primary focus on literature, theater, and music. Her artistic and academic work has appeared in journals and anthologies published by Playwrights Canada Press, University of Toronto Press, and others. Recent projects include the launch of her third album, Bloom, and the creation of a commissioned experimental performance installation entitled On Love. Naila.
So thank you, first of all, for coming to our plenary session, choosing a plenary session performance over the performance of the opening ceremonies and opening match of the World Cup that millions are watching. Thank you also to Laura Levin and Lisa Wolford Wylam for inviting me to participate in this plenary session and to speak about performance poetry in Canada. Montreal, circa 1999. A large manila envelope from the Canada Council for the Arts was wedged into the cramped mailbox of the old lopsided apartment building I lived in. I read it as I climbed the four rickety flights of stairs to my door and was surprised to learn about a new program called Spoken and Electronic Words, created to fund artistic projects by performance poets. Successful applicants received money to create and produce work and kept profits from product sales. Preposterous, I thought. Shortly thereafter, I conceived a project, submitted my first arts grant application, and 2 years later launched my first performance poetry album with the grant I received. Since the funding program's inception, many performance poets have become proficient grant writers, sat on Arts Council juries, developed relationships with grant officers, and learned to pitch projects that meet multiple guideline criteria in language that resonates with jurors. Over the past decade, performance poets in Canada have increasingly been interviewed by scholars, critics, and artists working on theses, dissertations, magazine articles, and documentary films. We have been asked to track our journeys, define our work, and state our influences. Many of us who are not white are almost always also asked to pinpoint what makes our work representative of whichever cultural signifier that piques the interviewer's interest. Then these interviewers usually collapse our poetry into musings on identity, shaped to illuminate the challenge of said segment of Canadian society. Our hetero, homo, trans, and queer white female and white male colleagues of various classes don't seem to be asked as often to fit into these petulant fantasies of Canadian multiculturalism and nationalism. Many of us have also noticed a dearth of substantive analysis of our work. Performance poet Kai Kello recently observed, quote, "They, academics and media critics, aren't aware of the forms and concerns that we engage. They are oblivious to many of the references we make, and in general, there's a lack of knowledge of the context within which our work should be situated. They don't know anything about poetry performance by Canadian artists of color. What this means is that they cannot engage our work in any profound way. They don't know how to think about our work, and instead of acquiring the tools to discuss it properly, they gloss it over, ignore it, or worse, dismiss it outright. We may be mentioned, but what we are doing is not explored. The same intelligence and attention to detail that we bring to our creative process is not applied to our work by academics or critics," end quote. It is an exciting and tumultuous time for spoken word, dub poetry, and rap poetry in Canada, as these three forms of performance poetry become further entrenched in the epistemological nerve centers of academia and public arts funding. For the past 14 years that I have worked as a performance poet in Canada and beyond, I have witnessed the performance poetry pendulum begin to swing from the outskirts to the mainstream. Assuming, of course, that academic inquiry and public funding are signs of the mainstream and not elements of yet another fringe. Prior to the arrival of the Manila envelope that fateful day, I created and performed poetry with little attention to how to define or reproduce it. The seduction of possible public funds and the attached project eligibility guidelines shaped the cultural product of my subsequent work and arguably that of many other practitioners. The new grant program was launched within the Canada Council's Writing and Publishing section, which also had grant programs for literary readings and book publishers. This pairing forced the Canada Council to differentiate between poetry readings and performance poetry performances, between poetry books and books by performance poets. This meant that standalone book projects, for example, were ineligible, but CD creation projects with accompanying chapbooks were. In the years following the inception of the Spoken and Electronic Words program, merchandise tables rife with CDs and self-published chapbooks appeared at events. CDs and independent book launches became a practitioner's rite of passage, and audience members now routinely asked to purchase performance poetry CDs and books. So the questions must be asked. What would have happened if the Canada Council had launched their performance poetry program in the theater section? Would performance poetry plays have filled company seasons? Had our funding been housed within visual arts, would we have made paintings with or from or to our poems? Had we been grouped under dance, might we have collaborated with choreographers and created performance poetry dances? Or had the Canada Council created a new section solely for performance poetry? What kinds of cultural products might have emerged? At a conference 4 years ago, I called the Canadian theater establishment a sophisticated fortress of whiteness. Specifically, quote, an elaborate, firmly founded windowless fortress with thick cement ceilings and thick cement walls that few theater practitioners of color have been allowed or qualified to permeate over the past few decades, end quote. I mentioned that the establishment seemed to be assessing a handful of new practitioners of color for future entry, and that I counted myself hopeful among those vying for entrance. Shortly thereafter, an arts administrator of a large Canadian theater company asked me to apply to their new artist development program. She said she had heard my paper, that the program was aimed at breaking down some of the concrete, and that I was on record as being critical of the theater establishment. She implied that the integrity of my critique hinged on whether or not I applied to their program. I declined. The program publicity materials emphasized the valuable insights that I would get for free from volunteering my time to the company for a year. There was no mention of the valuable insights the companies would get for free from me. A hierarchical relationship between company and artist had been predetermined. The fortress drawbridge had been lowered, and though we all know artistic intellectual traffic moves in multiple directions, the official discourse only acknowledged movement in one. Outsiders clamor in. I share this story to illustrate how mainstream conditions are erected through mechanisms like a theater company's program description, a funding body's organizational decision, and a researcher's analysis or lack thereof of a performance poet's of color's work. It is a process that I am tentatively calling the naming of normal, wherein some people with access to power occupy insider status and invite others in, often depending on trends in benevolence and the market. The unspoken assumption that those outside large institutions are not insiders elsewhere ignores that these outsiders have also erected firmly founded structures, opaque walls, thick ceilings, drawbridges, and the like. So what might it mean to meet outsiders and insiders at a location other than the grounds of either's respective residences? There are some, like me, who seek entrance to all kinds of spaces routinely involved in the naming of normal. Though we are not necessarily seeking permanent resident status, much less citizenship. Instead, the capacity to morph, reposition, reiterate, and reinvent oneself is a flexibility born of necessity for those who routinely fall outside normal in instances when normal is named. Yes, raucous and subdued, I have sweet smiled my way through. I have fit into tight spaces, white, poor, hetero, queer, francophone, middle class spaces. I have fit into narrow spaces, rich, anglophone, black, artistic, brown, allophone, academic spaces. Fit, I have fit into constructs of woman, constructs of man, definitions of human. But I came first. Before normal was named, I came with more styles, flexible like water, evaporate, condense, liquefy, and come back again as snow. That's how we flow with more styles, more styles, flexible like water, evaporate, condense, liquefy, and come back again as snow. That's how we flow. The movement to assemble an academic language of inquiry, framework of analysis, and methodology of critique of this burgeoning art form in Canada has begun, and much is in contention. Questions have been raised. Is performance poetry a genre, a practice, a discipline? Which academic department does its study belong in? Literature, performance studies, does that exist? Education, theater, who and what belongs in the canon? Guillermo Gomez Peña observed, quote, We are now allegedly installed in a fully globalized, post-racial, post-racist, post-sexist, post-ideological, post-civil rights era, and anyone who thinks otherwise is clearly out of touch with the times. End quote. It is precisely because this violent era of erasure is sweeping through the mainstream and the outskirts that the following two questions must haunt discussions of performance poetry studies in Canada. Can this emerging field of study avoid historical pitfalls of North American academia and not marginalize artists and scholars with regards to race, class, gender, sexual orientation, ability, and more? And can its critique deploy a rigorously interdisciplinary methodology that locates practitioners and audiences within the specific context that inform its creation, production, and reception? In comparison to performance poetry in Canada, Canadian theater is firmly in the mainstream, with years of substantive academic inquiry and 50-plus years of public funding. Some within Canadian theater have made provocative attempts to meet with those outside their familiar repertoires to engage in the challenging work of renaming normal. As they laboriously and imaginatively blast through decades of cement and rebuild with sustainable materials on new ground, it behooves those invested in the movement of performance poetry to the mainstream to take notice, lest we find ourselves in a similar rebuild 40 years from now. Thank you.
I realize that if I hadn't suggested we go in alphabetical order, I wouldn't have had to follow Naila. But thank you, Laura and Lisa, for inviting me to do this. And it is, I think, an historic occasion, which is a little daunting because I think it means that we're all making performative utterances on this panel, which is scary. I'm going to talk about the way in which Canadian Theatre Review, the journal, has constituted performance studies in Canada, as I see it, and it's very much as I see it. Sorry, yeah. Better?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. So the Quarterly Canadian Theatre Review is a crossover journal in a couple of senses. It attempts to reach a readership of academics, theatre professionals, and serious audience members. It crosses boundaries between theater and a broad range of things now understood to come under the rubric of performance. I want to argue that since its founding in 1974, CTR has functioned as a barometer of how the drama theater performance evolution / continuum has played out in Canada, and since 1986, how performance studies have been constituted by the journal. The moment of its founding by American draft resister Don Rubin, with the encouragement of TDR editor Richard Schechner, and generally throughout its first 12 years under Rubin, CTR understood itself to be an avidly post-colonial Canadian nationalist version of TDR, the drama review. Extending so far as to imitating the three-letter title and the consecutive issue numbering system. There was even a short period from winter 1982 to spring 1983 in which Schechner, together with Martin Eslin, Roman Sadlowski from Poland, and Claes England from Sweden, was on the editorial advisory committee. And Schechner contributed an essay, as did Eugenio Barba, to Volume 35. CTR did, however, consciously reject the use of drama in its title, opting for what the editors then understood to be the broader and less literary term, theater. From its first issue, CTR has been combative, prone to issuing performative utterances in its efforts to constitute a variously defined field. Through its first 12 years under Rubin, the journal was primarily focused, apart from a brief obsession with Poland, on the development of a Canadian national dramaturgy. I'll tell you later. It moved away from that focus after Rubin was succeeded by Robert Wallace as editor in 1982-3. In 1986, after 12 years and 47 issues into the run, they published a volume on issues in performance, in the editorial for which Wallace used the phrase performance studies for the first time in CTR's history. Since then, CTR can be understood without fanfare or indeed explicit articulation to have further broadened its scope and mandate to be more or less identical in terms of coverage, albeit with a Canadian focus, with that of TDR. According to my favorite source, Wikipedia, TDR, the Drama Review, quote, is a quarterly journal focusing on performances in their social, economic, aesthetic, and political contexts. The journal covers dance, theater, music, performance art, visual art, popular entertainment, media, sports, rituals, and performance in politics and everyday life. So too does CTR, but with less fuss. There has not been in Canada or in the UK the American-style turf wars experienced between theater studies and performance studies, partly because there's not been in Canada or the UK, as we've been hearing, the institutionalization of performance studies of the kind or to the degree that there has been in the US, with the concomitant struggles over resources that institutionalization necessarily entails and the institutional need to carve out turf. All CTR issues are special issues in that they're themed. And over the years and subsequent editors, the journal has published issues that cover the full gamut and more of TDR's reported subject range on, and I'll just give you some titles of issues, issues in performance, twice, popular theater, paratheater and popular culture, dance theater, music theater, twice, computing, solo performance, performance tirades, which is really an issue on performance art, zine theater, raves, parties, and streets, military and other reenactments, One Yellow Rabbit's High Performance Rodeo, site-specific performance, liveness and mediatized performance, spoken word performance, performance art, consuming performance, intersections of theater, bars, and restaurants, celebrity culture, and on variously culturally specific performance, theater and ethnicity, native theater, Arctic theater makers, Italian-Canadian theater, South Asian-Canadian theater, Chinese-Canadian theater, theater and the question of disability, African-Canadian theater, twice, and intercultural performance. Issues on themes not generally associated with performance studies also include essays, mixed seemingly indiscriminately and without fanfare, and that's the point, on ones with more traditional theater-based topics, on such things as cyber theater, gaming, popular theater, environmental performance, performance art, circus, carnival, cabaret performance, drag, stand-up, storytelling, and again, variously culturally specific and intercultural performance forms, including such things as reports on Native performance culture research from First Nations artists such as Flag Favel and Monique Mojica. Scripts, publishes a script in every issue. Scripts in quotation marks published in every issue range from traditional plays through spoken word works by the likes of Naila, to various kinds of performance score or record. Moreover, and more importantly, it's not all about coverage or subject matter. Essays on these and other topics also often use performance studies methodologies, as when in an issue on theater and translation, Ellen Mackay contributed a challenging, playful, and undeniably performance studies essay about self-translation in a Canadian's auto-performance of Americanness for the American Immigration and Naturalization Services, auditioning for the role of a lifetime, as she called it, as a U.S. citizen with covertly dual citizenship. The essay's central concern, and I think it's characteristic of performance studies as constituted through CTR, central to the essay's concerns were performance into being of social subjectivity or identity. And this comes back to some things that Susan was saying, and Aaron, actually. This is important because Canada, in my view, and this may itself be considered a performative utterance, in Canada, in my view, performance studies has emerged less as a field of study or until very recently and still vestigially? How do you say that word? As an institutional presence than as an approach or discipline. We have no heroic stories of the two men who gave birth to performance studies. So Don Rubin's account of the founding of CTR by three men is subtitled The Moment of Conception. Nor any stories of anyone marching into the theater studies department at my university or elsewhere and announcing that we were henceforth to be a department of performance studies. Though we were, for one brief shining moment, the School of Literary and Performance Studies in English, before folks became uncomfortable being known as SLAPSY. Why not HUGSY, we asked. We might have gotten along better. Indeed, for a field that in the U.S. has been typically, sometimes piously, characterized as trans, extra, or anti-disciplinary, in Canada, it seems to me, performance studies constitutes a discipline as clearly and in similar ways as literary studies does. And indeed, in my view, matters only insofar as it defines itself in disciplinary, if not traditionally disciplinary, terms. These terms have often, in a country historically obsessed with issues of national identities, and one that employs often self-congratulatory discourses of official multiculturalism, circulated less around NYU TDR-style theater anthropology or Northwestern-style rhetorical tradition, except insofar as it shares a linguistic philosophical interest in speech, than around something closer to Austinian Butlerian questions of the performative constitution of social subjectivities, dominant and diasporic. Thus, in the summer 2005 issue of CTR, called Canadian A, interrogates the very title and original mission of the journal, and together with the summer 2009 issue on intercultural performance, raises the question of how Canadianness might be performed in the intersectionally diasporic 21st century. Canada does not have the Schechner-Turner legacy of theater anthropology with its interest in liminality, street theater, paratheatrics, and exotic ritual, usually discovered elsewhere, including for Turner among the Hamatsa peoples of Canada's west coast. Nor do we have a secure institutionalized legacy of ethnic studies, constituted generally or specifically, though there are Aboriginal studies programs and there are occasional programs in Black, Latino, or Asian studies. Rather, we have ongoing issues about the performative constitution of diasporic subjectivities within a problematic and hierarchical official multicultural script, which incidentally explicitly excludes Canada's First Nations peoples, and within counterbalancing rhizomatic and intercultural performance movements engaging dominant culture versions of identity, national and more often local. So what we do have in Canada, at least according to my reading of CTR since 1986, is an understanding of lowercase performance studies that is fundamentally disciplinary, whose subject matter is as unlimited as that of literary studies in the 21st century, but that considers the world indiscriminately, a theatrical performance, a streetscape, a building, a city, a bar, a restaurant, a conference, a book, a discourse, a politic, not as texts to be read as in literary studies, but as performances, sites at which place and subjectivity are performatively constituted and through performance analysis understood. Whether or not performance studies is what that analysis is called, and it often hasn't been. So post and future script. After 7 years as editor-in-chief of CTR, 7 years before that as a member of an editorial collective, and no less than 25 years after I edited my first issue of CTR, I'm stepping down as of the spring 2011 issue to be succeeded as editor of CTR by this year's conference co-director for PSI, none other than performance and theater studies scholar Laura Levin. She is the first editor of CTR with a PhD in performance studies, and she's also the principal investigator on a major Shirk-funded project on performance studies in Canada, which is the first major research project to theorize and map the field as it's emerged in Canada. So we're all actually today doing her research for us. Anyway, the evolving field of of performance studies as represented by CTR is in good hands.
Very big shoes to fill. Am I the first woman editor of CTR? Or was there... Natalie Rewell was a co-editor.
Natalie was actually editor for a short time, solo editor for a short time. And Ann Wilson was co-editor for a long time.
Right.
And Catherine has been an associate editor for a long time.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting to talk about further. Our last speaker is Jane Wark, who is professor of art history at the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design in Halifax. She has written on contemporary art since 1970s, focusing on performance, video, and conceptual art. Her book, Radical Gestures, Feminism and Performance Art in North America, was published by McGill Queen's University Press in 2006 and reprinted in 2009. She is currently working on a monograph on the history of conceptual art in Canada and is one of a team of five curators producing an exhibition on this topic, which will open in September 2010 in Toronto and then tour to Halifax, Toronto, Montreal, Edmonton, and Vancouver. And I should also say one thing that I didn't mention in my opening is that they're actually... while the discipline of performance studies as such hasn't
really been mapped. I think that there are a number of people who have done a really good job of thinking about Canadian performance art and the histories of Canadian performance art, Jane being one of them, one of the first studies I had ever seen putting Canadian and American performance traditions in conversation with one another. And also Johanna Householder, who is here, who with Tanya Mars co-edited a brilliant collection of essays on women's performance art in Canada. So I just think it's important to mention those as well. So Jane, go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. Good morning, everybody. I gather, I'm not going to go into too much of a preamble, but because I think Laura set it up well, but I think I'm coming to this discussion from a somewhat different perspective than others, partly because I'm going to talk about some specific work that relates to the research that I've been doing rather than a kind of overview about the discipline, and also because I don't work in a university. I work in a very small college, and so I don't face or encounter many of the kind of I understand them, and I, you know, converse with people that. But in my own institution, I don't face those kinds of issues about programs and silos versus interdisciplinarity and so on. We just all try to get along. We have no money, and so we all just make it work. So, for this brief presentation, I would like to introduce some of the ideas and material I have recently been considering with regard to the possibility of how printmaking has served as an unexpected site of performativity. I have come to this work through a convergence between my previous studies of feminist performance art and my current research into the history of conceptual art. As I see it, the link between these two seemingly disparate practices is that they both caused a shift away from the high modernist prioritizing of aesthetic values that would be mainly from the 1960s and early 1960s, to say, away from that prioritizing of aesthetic values based on judgments about quality and taste. In the case of feminist art, the priority was placed instead on questions of how art could articulate social problems, while in conceptual art, it was on turning art itself into a self-reflexive and critical practice that placed emphasis on ideas and concepts rather than on materials, skills, and techniques of specific art disciplines. As my research into conceptual art began to develop around 2004, it became clear that I was facing a situation very similar to what I had encountered in my work on performance art. Namely, that while there was a growing body of worldwide scholarly interest in both these fields, the Canadian context was almost entirely absent. My intention, however, neither then nor now, is to not to uncover the hidden history of Canadian conceptual artists, but rather to explore and analyze how conceptual art emerged and developed within the specific conditions of the Canadian context. One of these contexts was a result of the internationalism of conceptual art. This was due not only to the portable nature of conceptual art — you don't need a studio to make conceptual art, you can carry it in your briefcase — but also to its deliberate strategy of undermining the power and authority of art world centers. It was in this context that the Nova Scotia College of Art and Design, which I will now refer to as NASCAD, emerged in the late 1960s and early 70s as an unlikely hotbed of international conceptual art. My proximity as a faculty member there to its archival sources have yielded a rich body of research. One area of particular interest is a program called the Lithography Workshop. It ran from 1969 to 76 and produced 289 prints by 76 artists, normally in limited editions of 50. The Litho Workshop started out following the Los Angeles Tamarin Workshop's so-called renaissance of artist printmaking. But by the second year, it had turned decisively in the direction of the kind of conceptual art that was then being fostered at NASCAD. This means that rather than espousing Tamarin's values of aesthetic and technical quality, the NASCAD prints use the medium of printmaking merely as a means to a conceptual end, that is, the demonstration of an idea by an artist. This conceptual premise resulted in the production of numerous innovative prints by Canadian, American, and European artists, but of these, I am only going to mention a small selection of what I consider to be a form of performative printmaking. In some cases, the artist never visited the college and sent the instructions by mail, a situation that perhaps stretches the parameters of what might be considered performative. For example, the American artist Saul LeWitt sent instructions for 10 prints, of which three were to be executed by the master printer and seven by students, following specific instructions such as, and this is also the title of the work, within a 20-inch square, using a black hard crayon, draw 10,000 freehand lines of any length at random. When LeWitt received the prints, and these were all then done by students, when LeWitt received the prints for signing, he initially objected to some of them for aesthetic reasons, but he ultimately realized that to reject them would undermine his own famous 1967 declaration that in conceptual art, the idea is a machine that makes the art and the execution is a perfunctory affair. Displacing the execution from the artist to a performance by students was also the basis of the print by the American artist John Baldessari. His print, however, resulted from a week-long performance in the college's gallery. For this piece, which he referred to as a punishment piece, Baldessari instructed what he called student surrogates and scapegoats to atone for the artist's sins by covering the gallery walls from top to bottom with the phrase, "I will not make any more boring art." Subsequently, the lithograph was produced from his sample text. Here, as with LeWitt's print, the authorial status and subjective agency of the artist is called into question through the process of deferring the work's execution to the performative activity of students. But despite this questioning, we must concede that in the end, this authority and agency remain intact, at least at the commodity level, since the ultimate purpose of these prints was to produce a saleable object sanctioned by the artist's imprimatur. A different kind of performative approach to printmaking is evident in prints by NASCAD faculty member Pat Kelly and the Vancouver husband and wife collective known as N.E. Thing Company. For Pat Kelly's A Shot in the Dark, two black intersecting lines were registered and printed on each sheet of paper. The artist then attempted to match these lines by manually repositioning each sheet on the printing bed, with the imperfect results of this performative action being superimposed by the blue ink. In the case of lithographed, photographed by N.E. Thing Company, 50 blank sheets of paper were run through the press, with each one documented by a photograph. Each photograph was then attached to its corresponding print and marked at the bottom with the artist's signature and corporate seal. Both of these prints fit within, that is, Pat Kelly's and this one, fit within the conceptual designation of art as an idea machine that makes the art. At the same time, however, they also create tension between conceptualism's hostility to the subjectivism of what LeWitt called the emotional kick of high modernism, and the fact that they relied upon the material evidence of the artist's physical and performative agency. The final three Litho Workshop prints to be noted here take yet another performative approach to printmaking. The first of these prints was executed in 1970 by Canadian artist Joyce Wieland. In keeping with the patriotic theme of her work at this time, she produced O Canada by pressing her lipstick mouth to the stone to form the words of the national anthem. O Canada's spare economy of means was commensurate with the austereness typical of conceptual art, yet it ran against the grain both through its embodied connotations and in its introduction of an explicitly feminine and erotic element. 2 months later, the American artist Vito Acconci further explored the potential opened up by Wieland's work for printmaking as the site of embodied performativity. And I just want to digress for a moment here to say that the situation in which these prints was normally produced is that the artist would come and spend time and work with the master printer. So Joyce Wieland was in Halifax then in the fall of 1970 along with Michael Snow, who was her husband at the time, and they were there for about 2 months. months. And so then 2 months later, that is in February of 1971, the American artist Vito Acconci came to Halifax, and he would have known of these prints, and he would have spent also a long duration there. The first print he did, Trademarks, was based on documentation of a previous performance by Acconci in which he attempted to bite as much of his body as he could reach. Kiss Off, though, was the other print that he did at this time. He did do a third print later, but this one is called Kiss Off. And it was, on the other hand, a unique production for the Litho Workshop. And it clearly seems to have been based in direct response to Whelan's O Canada. For Kiss Off, Acconci first feminized his body by applying lipstick and kissing his hands, but then expunged this feminine aspect by wiping the lipstick off his hands on the lithostone in a process he describes in the written text as rubbing off my female characteristics, cleaning myself up. As I have suggested elsewhere, Acconci here seems not only to abject the alien feminine within himself, but also to make a symbolic maneuver to resist the incursion of feminine and feminist authorship then emerging in the art world and so forcefully manifested in Whelan's work. These Litho Workshop prints are intrinsically interesting for their historical significance, but I would like to conclude with a brief reference to how their performative aspects have resonated in the work of a contemporary artist. Jason Fitzpatrick is a Vancouver-based artist who attended NASCAD in the 1990s, where he would have learned of these earlier prints. In 2007, he did a performance in Sackville, New Brunswick at the Owens Art Gallery called Bite and Burn, in which he had a solid black line tattooed on his spine, and a sequence of monoprints was made of this by pressing paper against the blood and ink. In 2009, Bite and Burn Encore, and this is actually the publicity for Bite and Burn Encore, but it shows in the photograph the tattoo from the first work. Bite and Burn Encore was held at the Mount St. Vincent University Art Gallery in Halifax. As we see here, the artist's statement explains the work in the spare and uninflected tones characteristic of conceptual art. But in actuality, the event itself was raw and visceral and made the audience witness to the stoic agony with which the artist endured this ritual ordeal of extreme printmaking. And the results of this... Oh, here we see the printmaker making a monoprint of the print. And the results of this then were exhibited in the gallery, which they were forced to warn people about with a sign on the wall saying that there was a biohazard involved. There's much more to say about these historical and contemporary works, but I will conclude there. And if there are any questions or further discussion, I'll be happy to take it up then.
So I'd like to take this opportunity, since we have this very specific and interested audience, to throw things open right away to discussion. So if there are any questions or comments, yes, Kim, would you like to step down to the microphone? Or,
sure. Yeah, actually, no. Yeah.
Or you can speak loudly.
No, I hear you.
We all know you can.
I never met a mic I didn't like. Thank you guys all so much for that. Hang on. I almost broke it. Thank you so much for this. It's exciting to see this conversation and to be here to hear it. It seems to me, as I was listening, Susan, I think you set the tone really well, thinking institutionally. And for me, your paper really resonated throughout the panel. And I found myself thinking, we seem to be in kind of a moment of paradox here. On the one hand, the kinds of performance studies work you've all been talking about seems resolutely interdisciplinary, especially Rick, I think your presentation really gives us a sense of how CTR has framed a very interdisciplinary conversation. And in that sense, it's one that very much pushes back against the kind of cultural nationalist boundaries that found a lot of intellectual production in Canada and that certainly shape its funding. But then on the other hand, there's the potential problem of getting further performance studies work funded, which Susan was talking so much about. So on the one hand, we've got an emerging performance studies discourse that resists Canada's intellectual narratives and nationalist narratives. On the other hand, we might need to court that. So I think the question I want to ask is, how institutionalized should performance studies in Canada be as it moves forward? Might one of the answers to some of the problems you were posing, Susan, be a Canadian Performance Studies Association? Or is that resolutely not the answer, not a road we'd like to go down?
Does anyone want to respond to Kim's question? Susan, maybe, since she was engaging with some of your ideas.
My response is this, I guess. I thought long and hard in the mid-90s about that very creation. And as a person who lives with no regrets, I might admit to that one as a bit of a regret. I think we perhaps missed a moment that we should have taken up. 15 years later, I'm a little less interested in associations than I once was, but I do. Having said that, in thinking about this panel specifically and thinking about the fate of performance studies in Calgary, I find it hard to imagine it moving forward in the ways in which we might all have full participation without, in fact, in some or other way, agreeing to that institutionalized context in the layers that I was outlining. So yes, it's a paradox, you're right.
Does anyone else want to respond? Or are there any other additional questions? Yeah, TL. Or comment.
What I want to do is take up the last two words of the name of this panel in Canada. And I want to, instead of asking a question, I'd like to throw some words at you. And in particular, I want to take up something that Jane said at the very beginning of your talk, your comments, where you're talking about your intellectual pursuit as thinking about the work that you're studying as happening within the specific conditions of the Canadian context. And I think that all of your papers did that in a really brilliant way, and I absolutely thoroughly enjoyed the whole panel. But what I want to ask you is about the relationship between specificity and generalization and the role of performance studies in Canada in an international intellectual context. And how portable is our work when we rely on regional specificity or a national specificity. Personally, I think that specificity is the only ethical way to do performance studies, but I also wonder in terms of getting circulation for our work and international publication, those kinds of things, I wonder how portable is our work when we locate our objects of study primarily in, as Jane said, a Canadian context.
Rick, do you want to try?
I'm amazed at how many people are here today. Mm-hmm. My answer before this morning, and maybe still is, would be that it's not. There's very little interest outside of Canada in the publication of work about Canadian performance. Historically, there hasn't been. I've occasionally snuck a chapter into a book about other things that's about Canada. And that's the chapter that doesn't get mentioned in the reviews of the book, sort of thing. I don't think it is very, frankly, right now. What to do about that, I don't know. Strategizing, trying to sell things doesn't work because it belies the practice. So I'm not very hopeful about that.
Has anything been written about why this is? I mean, this is something that certainly I've encountered. I was discouraged against working on Canadian stuff by some of the people who were, when I was doing my dissertation, by some people, but for this precise reason that it wasn't going to be marketable when I was looking for a job. TL, you've been experiencing this in the work that you're doing right now. Does anyone on this panel or out in the audience have a sense of why... we're so unpopular? I actually think it's a serious question.
Well, I think also, if you look at in Canada, I think if this conference was happening in Australia, there would be potentially a panel that said performance studies in Australia, performance studies in Hungary, performance studies in appalling. I think probably the only place in the world that this panel wouldn't happen is in the United States. There wouldn't be a panel that said performance studies in the United States. And I think that if American scholars started saying performance, you know, feminist performance in the United States in the titles of their books and actually locating specificity in an American context, that would
happen. Can I respond?
Absolutely.
I think I agree with you, except that, of course, when Americans and or Europeans do that, it's just the default position. They are writing about performed studies in the United States. They just don't acknowledge it. So they don't feel they have to. But I think that my sense really is, you know, part of the problem is that the research is so young and that we just have to keep doing it. And who cares? Frankly, you know, let's just keep doing it because there's so much interesting work that it has been done and is being done here that it will inevitably speak for itself. We just have to bring it to light and, in a sense, kind of stop worrying about negotiating. That's a losing battle. It really is. That's just my sense of it, you know, and my research on conceptualism was really driven by this huge this exhibition called Global Conceptualism. Canada got less than a paragraph in this monstrous doorstopper of a catalog. Well, there's only one way to solve that, and that's just do the work. Because whoever wrote that didn't know anything about Canada, obviously, because it hadn't been done. So,
Nayula, did you want to...
Thank you. I'm fascinated by hearing the conversation take place because it's it reminds me of the language that Jose Munoz used yesterday was minoritized knowledge, something to that effect. And so what I hear you calling for, TL, and some of the comments is a flexibility, right? A flexibility born of necessity, which is so often that same kind of flexibility that so-called outsiders need to invoke, that people who are minoritized need to accumulate and mobilize in order to do things. I think that there are multiple approaches. You know, there's definitely, and if we look to minoritized knowledge and minoritized communities within Canada itself and the strategies that these people have used to become part of the Canadian dialogue, that we may find ways in which then we can think about how to position Canada on an international scale or in an international conversation. There is a plethora of knowledge that minoritized people within Canada have accumulated and have acquired, and they may be outside, right? Allegedly outside. And it's the work of instead of reinventing the wheel, now what are we going to do with Canada on an international scene? Perhaps looking at what people have been doing here for over 100 years and how they have created community and made very strong international links and have created a very strong international presence for themselves. There is knowledge here that may be outside of what we're accustomed to accessing.
Exactly what the limits of each of those terms might be.
I think that's a really useful comment. If I can just speak to it, just two notes. One is I think it's really difficult to, I think it's essential that we look at how terms resonate differently in different contexts, so that the term performance studies in one context means so much and in another context is thoroughly without meaning or is frankly simply a brand. Certainly in the context that I teach, the idea of turning our program into a performance studies program comes up less as a reflection of what it is that we're doing, although many of us are practicing performance studies, and more as a way to market and to sell. Terms like performativity is, I guess, this is not new news. This is what, of course, Shannon Jackson talks about in her book. The term performativity resonates one way in one context, one way in another context. So I think we have to be careful about feeling that, especially when we're talking in an international context, that these terms all resonate or should resonate in the same way. That being said, I think it's so interesting that you bring up this point of the framing of performance studies in Canada, because I think you're right that it's problematic. And I just want to draw your attention to the history. I don't know how familiar you are with this, but the association that Susan was talking about, this term in Canada versus Canadian performance studies, Canadian theater studies, has been a huge thing over the last couple of years. So it's something we're very familiar with. I sat in the room of this association. I'm now the vice president of the organization. I was a board member back then, when we struggled for about an hour and a half to 2 hours talking about whether we were going to continue to be called the Association for Canadian Theater Research or the Canadian Association for Theater Studies. It took a very, and at one point it was actually going to be potentially called the Canadian Association for Theater and Performance Studies, or CATPER. I think Natalie Alvarez was in the room when this conversation, is Natalie here? You were in the room when this conversation was taking place. It was a really interesting conversation, and there were people who strongly would not have Canadian, the Canadian Association for Theatre Research. It was just fundamentally against the kind of nationalist argument that they felt that this association was making, and they were worried that if it was called, the reason why we moved to Canadian Association for Theatre Studies was actually because we wanted to open things up to the international. We felt it was too insular, that it was just Canadians talking to Canadians. And we wanted to welcome people who were working on different issues. But it, certain people who actually have been mentioned various times in these kinds of conversations were dead set against it. So this is one of the fights that we're having here, is in Canada versus Canadian. So thank you so much for your comment. It's sort of dead on. Yeah. Right.
Insistence that scholars in Canada should be working on Canadian subjects in order to promote cultural nationalism. And we want to put an end to that. He's aware that many scholars in Canada are working on international topics and other topics. So in a way, it's moving beyond a very particular discursive context. But in another way, those of us who live so close to the giant imperialist monolithic South are very aware of the extent to which Canadian distinctiveness can become invisible through U.S. cultural imperialism. And many of the scholars on this panel, their work circulates internationally and isn't marked as Canadian, necessarily. So Kim Soga and Laura Levin published a recent piece in TDR about Canadian performance studies. Eric Hurley, Jen Harvey published internationally about Canadian topics, as do Susan Bennett, Eric Knowles, Tracy Davis. So there is a sense of we here are particularly invested in distinctive genealogies. What is different about the way that performance studies discourses are emerging here than at New York or in Chicago, much less in other global contexts? So those are some of my understandings of why looking at the specific disciplinary emergence or interdisciplinary emergence to see in what ways the Canadian paradigm differs from the U.S. paradigm is an important thing for us. Because as Rick Knowles mentioned, we didn't have a kind of turf wars here where performance studies was defined as theater's other. And what that means is that there's not nearly so much of a resistance as there was in the American paradigm to considering aesthetic performance, theater performance art, as well as cultural performance within the district of performance studies. But a very strong difference that I perceive between performance studies in Canada and many of the European genealogies and derivations is there's a much greater investment in critical race studies and indigenous knowledge here than, and also a very strong investment in gender and sexuality studies that I don't see being nearly as prominent in certain European configurations. So I think we're looking at what is distinctive as well as what is common.
Kim, actually, there's someone who hasn't spoken, and she's standing up at the back. He or she, I can't see. Naila, do you want, so you don't want Erin to respond?
Yes.
Okay. Because she might have the expertise to respond to precisely that blind spot.
That would be fantastic. Yeah.
Okay, that was a bit of a setup.
or if you don't want
No.
I don't know if Catherine's in here right
she
now.
She is.
But Catherine would be an expert.
Do you want to talk to it too?
To that because you've worked in the trenches on these issues, precisely.
I work in the bars, and I really want to be to the answer. I am not going to call my Quebecois colleagues Canadian.
Right.
I say this laughing, but I think Erin brought it up in her presentation. In some ways, the irony of this discussion for me, because I have worked between French and English communities, both in Quebec and outside right. Quebec, because there are substantial French communities outside Quebec. Mm-hmm. Is that I think that maybe something that is typically Canadian about the way we approach this is that we don't take the term Canadian for granted. And I think, as my Mohawk colleague mentioned, many people who live on Canadian, on the territory we politically call Canada, for political reasons, mm-hmm. do not call themselves Canadian. So I think taking up perhaps Rick's point about how the formative constitution of identity has played out in Canada
has not been only a scholarly question. It has been a question of socio-political structures. But I am struck that perhaps that's something that we need to articulate more explicitly for some of our international colleagues. Because for us in Canada, I am not kidding when I say if I want to continue to work with some of my Quebecois colleagues, I cannot refer to them as Canadians without problematizing what I'm doing and doing that, because they would not self-identify in that way. And many would argue that the only reason that they are living on Canadian territory, as would some of my Mohawk friends would argue, would be because of aggression of a colonial power, not because they've chosen this identity or identify with it. Minority Francophone communities sometimes have quite different perspectives on this. So this is a very, very complicated question, I think, for us in Canada, and I think we see that playing out in the way we discuss reform studies here.
Can I add just, thank you, Catherine, that was lovely. May I add just briefly that I think also work from Canada, by which I mean predominantly English language Canada, and work from Quebec travels quite differently internationally, both in terms of the artistic work and the scholarly work. So to be very reductive, but since we're speaking in sort of stereotypes at the moment, English, and Jen has written about this in terms of English-Canadian work in Britain particularly, is seen as, I think Jen called it the boring slash alarming dichotomy. So work from English Canada is either boring, as are we English Canadians boring, hence all the invocations of snow and whiteness, and work from predominantly Quebec is on the one hand kitschy, hence it goes to Las Vegas, and on the other hand, right, interesting and visually stimulating. So these differences, which are at once political and historical and linked to different intellectual and artistic traditions, also mean that we have different kinds of presences on the international stage, if you will.
I think we could talk for a long time. Maybe we need that association. I think we've actually reached our time. I just want to say just one thing to add to that and then just make an announcement that I think we also need to mark that another discussion needs to be had around the performativity of Canadianness in terms of our continual insistence on distinctiveness, and that there is a lot of privileges that come along with, you know, we've talked about some of them, but of calling ourselves Canadian. And it's something that I've noticed, I studied in the States and moved back here, that the kind of insistence on distinguishing ourselves from the United States is also a way of disavowing our connection with things that are going on and that Canadians are doing in other parts of the world, i.e. what we're doing in Afghanistan, etc. We could go on for a long time. So we need to be careful about that as well. That's something that Shauna Dempsey was talking about in her performance last night at Buddy's. I want to encourage people to see the many performances by Aboriginal artists that are taking place at this conference, some of which I think are specifically staged in order to talk back to performance studies in this context and abroad. One of them is taking place this afternoon. It's curated by Fado Performance Art Center by Laurie Blondeau. It'll be taking place from 4 till 6 o'clock in Butterfield Park. She's an artist from Saskatoon. Another is by the Little Embers Youth Group, First Nations Youth Group, directed by Andrea Brassard. And this is actually in a certain way, an international work, since they're ultimately going to be collaborating with a professor at the University of Utrecht. And Utrecht is, of course, holding performance studies next year. So this is a great international connection. And I encourage you also to come to our plenary tomorrow, which is on performances of trans-Indigeneity, where hopefully we can put Indigenous performance from different parts of North America in conversation with one another. And I thank you guys so much for showing up to a session on Canadian performance.